Whatever the emotional turmoil stirred up by this independence vote, the notoriously thrifty, penny-pinching, pound-saving Scots are making the biggest bet of their lives this week.
The smallest yes vote we've had is 46% once you leave the undecideds to one side. The biggest is 51, from which one concludes it's close, but one also probably concludes that still the odds on the no side winning are rather better than those of the yes side. But with a few days to go, I don't think anybody would be wanting to put too much money on the outcome, given the polls are suggesting that it's not very far away from 50-50.
Right. That's one of the many pointy-headed professors watching the polls and taking the temperature of the people of Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, Inverness and Macduff, who will get to vote to decide if the United Kingdom shall become something less, say the ununited fiefdom. Doesn't have much of a ring to it there. Well, however much betting money there is on the neck-and-neck Scottish independence referendum on the 18th, in economic terms, independence might just be a costly proposition for all concerned. Pippa Malgren is a former advisor on the United States National Economic Council and the author of a new book, Signals, The Breakdown of the Social Contract and the Rise of Geopolitics. Pippa, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So this is economically costly, at least if you look at the numbers, to both Scotland and to England. Can you run them down for us?
Well, yeah, look, in broad terms, first of all, nobody really knows what the cost is going to be because this hasn't happened before. So there are lots of questions about who owns what. Like, for example, the British defense capability that's in Scotland. How many of the RAF fighter jets really will end up belonging to Scotland versus the UK? If you try to split the national health care system between Britain and Scotland, where do you draw the line? You know, how this morning there was an estimate early today about a £400 million shortfall for the healthcare system if you separate Scotland from the United Kingdom. So part of the problem is actually nobody really knows, and nobody did the numbers much because they didn't really think they would vote yes.
Long term, do the Scots stand to benefit if they can create a self-sustaining, prosperous little country there in the north?
So my own view is that the Scots believe that they have a lot of wealth because of the oil in the North Sea. And I think this is an incorrect judgment, partly because Scotland is not Saudi Arabia, right? It's not cheap to pull that oil out of the ground. It's the most expensive place in the world to harvest oil. So there isn't actually much money in it. And it's not actually owned by the British government. It's owned by the oil companies who have the licenses. So unless they want to nationalize it, they're not going to own it either. So then what else have they got? And I think this is where they begin to underestimate their revenue-generating ability. And the bottom line is, I think it will work if they introduce their own currency and they devalue it so that their goods become much cheaper. Whiskey gets a lot cheaper, and then they can earn their way into prosperity. But they also need to lower their tax rate, and their competitor is going to be Ireland. That's the country with the lowest tax rate in Europe of about 15% for corporates. And if they can do that, they can attract business. But if they don't do those two things, then I think they're really going to struggle to generate enough GDP and revenue to sustain themselves.
Does Ireland compete favorably with Britain at this point? And is that an object lesson for the Scots going forward?
Yeah, and Ireland is the big example for everybody in Western Europe of just how much business and wealth creation you can attract if you lower the tax rate below everybody else. But the interesting thing is the European Union wants Ireland to raise their taxes and not compete with everybody else. So the pressure on Scotland is going to be formidable.
And if the Scots enter the fray here, they're basically sharing a smaller piece of the pie.
That's right. So then the Scots seem to think that they can just stick with the pound. But the Bank of England has said, we can't be responsible for you guys, you know, if you're a different country. So the best you can do is have pounds in your bank account, but no access to the Bank of England. And the Scots say, well, we don't need it, which is kind of ironic, given that this whole crisis, financial crisis for the United Kingdom, began with Royal Bank of Scotland, which required a massive bailout and is still costing the British public and will do for years to come. So why the Scots think that this will never, ever happen again is kind of interesting.
Well, you know, you wonder what this vote would be like had the Royal Bank of Scotland not had those problems. And it was looking, you know, great compared to, say, the Bank of England. But that's, you know, that's an abstract point at this at this stage.
That's right.
So let's think about those RAF fighters you were talking about. Where are they mostly stationed? Is there a base for them? I mean, because
there is.
Where?
There's a place called RAF Lucars. It's a really interesting moment in history because here we have the relationship between NATO, particularly the United States, and Russia really deteriorating to the point that Russians are sending in their long-range bombers and their fighter jets to do incursions into airspace in Finland and Sweden, definitely into British airspace over Scotland. So if Scotland pulls out, then the question is, how are they going to scramble those jets, which right now they're having to do not infrequently? And how are they going to finance scrambling those jets? You know, who's going to fly them? You know, how are they going to maintain a military? This is a very expensive proposition at a moment in history when I think Russians will find it, at a minimum, amusing to test the new response capability.
And if the Brits were to take the Russian example, they would just annex the bases in Scotland, like Russia
indeed,
annexed the
indeed.
Crimea.
Exactly. Well, and that raises a really interesting point. Look, what's happening in Scotland is not actually a local phenomena. This is part of a global phenomena. We're seeing all over the world, people wake up and say, you know, I don't like the way the finances in my nation are handled. I don't understand why all the wealth is going to some other guy and not to me. Why do I still belong to this country? Maybe I can set up my own thing. So this explains the Russian separatists in Ukraine who say, let's create our own country and be aligned with Russia. It explains the Catalonians in Spain who say, we don't want to belong to Spain and the euro anymore. We want to be independent. It helps explain why the UK is talking about leaving the EU. And it also explains why we have this movement in California, which I think now has like 1.3 million signatures on the petition to break California into five new states. And my home state of Maryland has a conversation about splitting in half. So this separatist independence phenomena is much bigger than Scotland alone.
Well, I can't decide between whether I want a Basque passport or a Texas passport if this goes down the way you're suggesting.
Oh, I want a Texas passport.
Pippa
no
Malgrin,
question.
Founder of the DRPM Group and author of the new book, Signals, the Breakdown of the Social Contract and the Rise of Geopolitics. Thanks, Pippa.
Thank you.